Welcome to Real Medicine, Real Lives. I'm Dr. Yasser Sombel, and together we're showing medical expertise in a human way. Hello, and welcome everybody to Real Medicine, Real Lives. I'm your host, Dr. Yasser Sombel, and today we're exploring the human side of healing, the moments when recovery feels impossible and the voice in your head says you're not doing enough. Joining me today is Wendy Carroll, a global biotechnology and clinical operations executive with over 25 years of experience, leading innovation and transformation in healthcare. She's worked with rare diseases, gene therapy, and medical affairs. And today she's helping organizations and individuals approach healing and health and leadership with compassion and purpose. Wendy, thank you so much for joining me today. Welcome to Real Medicine, Real Lives.
Thank you.
So let's start here. Many people and patients feel self-doubt, frustration during recovery, especially when progress feels slow. This segment explores how mindset encouragement and small victories help rebuild self-worth through healing process. So let's first, talk about why do so many people feel like they're failing at healing when recovery takes longer than expected?
Well, I think it's a good question. And I know I've felt that myself. But I think what we look at in today's world, everything is instantaneous. So we also think that that's how we should recover. When we see those in the media, including social media, they seem to recover quickly from illnesses or injuries, and we think we should be on the same track they are. In reality, we only see part of the picture. Each individual recovers differently, and the images we see in media and social media only show the positive side of things. They don't show the hard work and struggle that goes on behind the scenes for people to get, fully recovered from whatever it is that they've had, whether it's an illness or an injury. And the other thing we have to remember is these people that we see on TV and the movies, et cetera, they have a team that's with them daily, just focused on their recovery. And they don't always have to focus on everything else that we all have to focus on in our normal lives. The most important thing to think about healing is to let yourself rest. Do what your care team asks you to do and don't push to heal faster. Because sometimes you can actually cause more damage and extend your recovery even further if you try and push yourself to do something too fast. Remember to give yourself grace and the grace to take the time to heal and to get back to where you need to get back to.
That's excellent. I mean, I think it goes back to that whole saying, right? Patience is a virtue, right? Mm-hmm. So you got to be patient with anything that happens. So, how can patients remind themselves that healing is not a race, but it's a journey, and to kind of maintain that patience?
It's hard. I'm not going to say it's an easy thing to do, but you need to listen to your body. Your body will actually tell you when it's fully healed. It'll tell you how you're recovering. And you need to stop comparing yourself to others. If you see somebody who seems to recover quickly, their health situation may not be the same as yours. They may not have the same underlying conditions. There may be something about, if you have a sprained ankle, maybe their sprain wasn't quite so bad, where yours is close to having all the tendons torn. Just ask, and also remember to ask your care team, whether it's the physician, the physical therapist, the nurse, if your recovery is going as they expect it, and if there's anything you can do to improve this. Sometimes they will give you other tricks and things to try to help you speed up your recovery, but as long as you're on track with what they are expecting for your recovery time, take a deep breath. Make sure you do not feel in your body that something is wrong that you need to follow up with, but take a deep breath, remember the patience and to give yourself grace and keep moving forward at the pace that you're supposed to.
Excellent. So can you share a story maybe that you're aware of somebody kind of overcame the self-doubt during recovery and maybe what steps they took to get there?
Yeah, I think some of it, there's a few different things. I always think of pregnancy. We see these images of stars who, within a month of having a baby, they're back to their slim figures. Or you hear those people that say, oh, I can fit into my jeans now that I wore when I was in high school. Hey, great. That's really not how it works. Most people, it's going to take you at least 6 months if not a year, to really bounce back. And I know for me, when I had both of mine, my children, my weight bounced back really quickly. However, it took a good almost year to bounce back fully with the same energy I had, you know, really fitting back into my clothes and just feeling like a normal person. If you think about it, when you have a newborn, there's a lot of sleepless nights. Caring for the newborn, it's a change in your routine and it takes some getting used to. I did learn to give myself grace and not compare myself to any pictures I saw on TV, in a magazine, or on social media, or other people's stories, because that wasn't the reality that I personally was facing. So I enjoyed the moment, enjoyed what was going on, knew from my physicians, both on the, you know, the pediatrician, that the baby was doing well, from my obstetrician that I was doing well and I was recovering as I was supposed to, and even from my general practitioner that everything was going well. And I just learned to live in that and just live in the moment with what was going on at that moment in time and not think about, am I going fast enough? Am I getting back into jeans that I wore in high school? Or do I even want to do that?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting that you said that. You know, like, there's so much, the social media aspect of things, I think, changes a lot of perspectives. Like, my son, you know, he's into kind of fitness, and he'll come to me and say, I saw this guy on social media, and he did this, you know, exercise for 3 days, and all of a sudden, he's way bigger and or lost weight. And I'm like, you know, there's probably a big lag time between their initial presentation and when they present the post results, right? So you're absolutely right. You know, I mean, I think that part of has really changed how people think. You know, it makes people want this instant gratification and this quick fix to everything, and that's just not possible. Mm-hmm. You know, so I agree.
Yeah. And the other is depends on your age too. You know, the older you get, the harder it is to recover from
absolutely.
Something that happened.
Absolutely.
And we have to remember that and give ourselves grace as we age.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think it goes along with, you know, just general things like just trying to lose weight. You know, people want this quick, yeah. Like, can I lose 50 pounds in, you know, 3 days? And that's just not feasibly possible. You know, I mean, of course, yeah. You know, with all these new drugs coming out, you know, people think it's just a quick fix, but it doesn't take away from lifestyle modification and time. You know, I completely agree. So, you know, you mentioned, you know, things about your general practitioner, et cetera. So what role, you know, does encouragement from doctors, family, community members, you know, help you and help patients feel like, you know, this is enough at the time for the progress that they're making?
Yeah, no, encouragement from others is crucial to actually, you know, getting better yourself. You mentioned the weight loss and, you know, wanting to lose 50 pounds in 3 days, which isn't realistic. But the other thing to remember, and something that your doctor or nurse, you know, somebody may tell you, is remember how long it took you to put that weight on. It didn't take you 3 days to put it on. Remember that, and remember it's going to take just as much time, if not longer, to actually lose it and change some of your lifestyle and some of your habits. Your medical care team, the doctors, physical therapists, nurses, anybody that you're working with, they can inform you if things are progressing as expected. And if there's anything else you can do, or maybe that you're not doing, to help make sure that your recovery stays on track. But having your family who's there to help you and a community around you that can help you is equally as important. You need that support, and you need them to be able to help where it's needed, but not do everything for you or push you to get back to your normal routine as quickly as possible. They need to be able to understand what you're trying to understand what you're going through and empathize a little bit to know when they can push and when not. Maybe first thing in the morning, you have all your energy and you can do most of your normal things. But after 1, 2 o'clock, you really need your family or your community to step in and provide that support for you. And that's when you need to be able to ask for it and realize that just because you're asking for help, it doesn't mean that you can't do anything or that you've failed. Everybody needs help at some point, and I know that's hard. The other thing that actually may be useful if you've not talked to a therapist before is actually working with a therapist to help you with that mental health recovery, because sometimes when you have have catastrophic illness or a change in, you know, your health journey, it's not just the physical being that's impacted, it's also your mental health that's impacted. And you may need to think about how to do some workarounds to do things that you used to do that you're no longer able to in the same way.
Excellent. Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, you know, you can't, I think that makes perfect sense, you know, for encouragement, even taking your own steps. I mean, part of my weight loss journey, one of the things my trainer used to tell me all the time was, you know, stop worrying about what the scale says, but, you know, take like profile pictures. And so see, you can see your actual progress mm-hmm. rather than, you know, just visualize it by the scale, because sometimes the scale can be misleading. So, no, I agree with what you're saying. And so these are, mm-hmm. you know, so that goes into the next question of, you know, how do small wins during treatment help people rebuild their sense of worth?
Yeah, you need to remember to celebrate every small win. If it's a weight loss journey, celebrate every pound or maybe every inch that you've lost. Look at different ways to celebrate. It's not, yes, you want to lose 50 pounds, but it's a half a pound, it's 1 pound, it's maybe I didn't have ice cream every night after dinner or something. Celebrate what you've actually won and what you've actually changed. If you have a broken leg or, you know, hip replacement, and are now really starting to be able to walk again, small milestones like, hey, I walked 10 steps today. That's great. I was able to do it. I couldn't do that yesterday. And I was able to do the 10 steps without a cane or a walker. Then set another mini goal, like maybe by the end of the week, I'm going to walk across the hallway without any, you know, walking aid, or I'm going to walk down the driveway to the sidewalk. Every small win adds up and it continues to encourage you to move more and go further. And by celebrating the small wins, you encourage yourself to continue to go on that journey to your ultimate goal. And, you know, celebrating a small win can just be even a quick, yay, I did this today, and having your family celebrate that with you and, you know, get a hug or call a friend and, you know, text back and forth, find that support person who's going to be your hype person and who's going to be along with you on the journey to cheer you on, whether it's a trainer at the gym as you're going through your own, you know, health and lifestyle change or fitness change, or, you know, it's your spouse or it's a child that, you know, your child, or it's a coworker. But anybody who can help celebrate what you've accomplished and remind you where you were and how far you've come.
Perfect. Okay, everybody, this has been an interesting segment so far. We're going to take a little break, and coming up, we're going to talk about how to find your voice in the healthcare system, even when it feels overwhelming or intimidating to speak. So don't go anywhere. We're coming back with some really good information with Wendy Carroll.
Stick with us. We'll be right back with more real stories, real breakthroughs, and real lives transformed.
And we're back. I'm Dr. Yasser Sombol. Let's dive right back into today's medical conversation. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Real Medicine, Real Lives. Want more of what you're watching? Stay connected to Real Medicine, Real Lives and every Now Media TV favorite, live or on demand, anytime you like. Download the free Now Media TV app or on Roku or iOS to unlock nonstop bilingual programming in English and in Spanish. You can also listen to our podcast version anytime on www.now.nowmedia.tv. From business and leadership to health and culture, Now Media TV is streaming around the clock, ready whenever you are. Welcome back, everybody. I'm here with Wendy Carroll. And in this segment, we're talking about something every patient struggles with, finding your voice in the healthcare system. When medical conversations feel overwhelming, it's easy to feel small or unheard. Wendy is here to help us understand how to reclaim that power. And I think this is a very interesting topic because, you know, as a healthcare provider, I really hear some of this feedback sometimes from people when they come see me in the office and follow up after being hospitalized, et cetera, you know, about, you know, what they were unhappy about, some of their concerns not being heard. So, you know, it takes us into the first question, Wendy, is why do so many patients feel so small or powerless in medical conversations?
I think partially it's they don't know how to speak to medical professionals. And we've been brought up to think that medical staff are all powerful and should not be questioned. I mean, I think that goes back way back. We're just starting now to ask questions and to really have those conversations. I think in the medical fields, we're not always taught how to relate to patients or how to encourage their feedback and questions. You have to build that relationship or rapport with the patient. But I think, you know, in today's world, medical professionals may only have 10 or 15 minutes allotted per patient when they see their patient. So it's really difficult to do this and manage their health issues as well. I don't know if you're seeing this in your practice where you're pressured to actually only see patients. You have 10, 15 minute slots back to back, so you don't always have time to get into it or to really talk to the patients.
Yeah, no, it's a very, you're absolutely right. You know, I mean, I'm in private practice, so I kind of control my own schedule. Nonetheless, I still have to see patients. And so, you know, everybody comes in a 15 minute interval. I try my best to make sure that everybody gets the time that they need. You know, some people need a lot of time and some people need less time. So it kind of works out. I also want to take the flip side of that. And I think, you know, healthcare providers need to make it easier for patients to talk to them in the sense of, we overwhelm people with information that they just don't understand, right? And so You have to be able to break that down into a simple concept for people to understand what you're talking about. Now, at some point, it gets to be really hard because there's a lot of physiology and pathology and et cetera that just makes it hard to explain it, you know. So a lot of times with people, I tell them, you know, something like, well, your heart is like your house. It has architecture, plumbing, and electricity. So we're addressing one of these three factors to try to explain that to them. So I completely agree with you. And so, you know, it goes to the next thing where, you know, how can somebody prepare questions or notes to make sure their voice is heard?
Part of it is actually keeping a notebook handy. So when those questions come up or something happens that you think your physician or your care team needs to know about, you can actually write it down at that time so you don't forget about it. And always keep a list of your current medications in there, along with any issues you've had with them or even getting them. And also make sure that you keep a list of when you take those medications. So again, that you're bringing full information to the physician to start that conversation. Bring that to your appointment. Let the care team know that you have a few questions for them to talk about during your appointment and really open up and ask those questions. The other is, I think now with the electronic medical records and patient portals, there really is an ability to have more of this conversation even outside of your actual physical appointment. And telehealth is another way to do this. And some people may actually find it easier to use the electronic medical record and type a message to their doctor in between visits. They have a question that comes up, they forgot about something. You know, they can easily type the question in, send it off to the doctor who the physician or part of their care team can actually respond and maybe take a little bit more time to craft the response so it's a little easier to understand. And this way also you get either a written response so you can have something that you can refer back to that you can understand, or you can have a phone call and a telehealth visit. Or if it's something urgent, you can tell that patient, hey, I need you to come in. When can we do this? You know, I can see you tomorrow at X time. So it really helps the patients make sure their voice is heard and also confirming sometimes that everything is okay, that what they're seeing or feeling is natural.
So I want to take this one more step and ask you this question, and maybe this doesn't completely relate, but you know, when people are bringing this journal in, so I have a lot of patients that come to me and say, I read this online or I read that online, and there's 50 different websites of, you know, relaying information that may have nothing to do with what's going on with them, but somehow their search has extrapolated it to that. And so what would you tell people when they're writing these notes and they have these questions about how important it is to bring that research with them, or maybe to not bring that research with them and just bring their question and have it answered, you know, the way it should be answered?
Yeah, it's probably better to bring the question and have it answered the way it should be answered and ask them for resources. Ask, you know, are there certain websites I should go to look for this? And some of the advocacy websites I know for, you know, heart disease, the American Heart Association is usually a good resource, but don't go to Dr. Google or Dr. Chat and put in a question and find all these horrible things that you think it could be. Really talk to your doctor first. get the right resources from them and look at those resources. And if you continue to have questions, again, go back to your doctor with those questions. Sometimes doing your own research can cause you more harm than good.
Great. And can you give us an example, maybe again, where a patient's voice changed the outcome of their care?
Yeah, we've just gone through this with my daughter who had some issues with wound care. And she kept pressing because she kept saying something's not wrong, right? Something's not right. She got a second opinion and it still didn't answer the question. And then we finally found a clinic. They went in, they took her seriously. One being female and two being under the age of 30. Sometimes I know that's hard, but they took her seriously. And within 6 weeks, the wound had fully healed. So we did get some wound care specific treatment. But that really, with her advocating for herself and really pushing to get an answer, it meant that she didn't have to live with this or potentially have another surgery to take care of what was happening, because she had learned who to trust eventually.
Yeah, I mean, I've been in that situation, you know, where somebody said, you know, this doesn't make sense, and I feel like this should be done, and, you know, I end up doing it, and they're right. So, I mean, people are aware of their own bodies, and it makes sense, you're right. You know, so how does empowerment in healthcare help people feel more hopeful and in control?
The more you have that conversation and the more you feel empowered to ask questions and also for your care team to actually listen to you and understand when your body's not, something's not right in your body, you know how you feel. You know your body. People need to listen to what you think may be going wrong. And the more you do that, the more you're going to find out either what you're feeling is normal, it's what's expected in this instance, or, hey, you know what? There really is something wrong here and we needed to do this. Thank you for bringing it to my attention. It helps patients feel like they're more of a partner in that, in their care. If they don't feel like it's, oh, somebody talking at me, they're actually working with me to make sure that I'm better.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, you know, so the other thing is, how do you, quickly maybe tell us how family members can advocate without overstepping their boundaries?
Sometimes it just takes having a family member go with you to your appointment, and you can either ask the family member, or as a family member, ask if somebody's having a challenge, do you want me to go to your appointment with you? Because this way they won't feel so overwhelmed with all the information, because there's somebody else there listening, and between the two of you, you can actually make sure that the information is understood and that you have somebody else who's heard it and can help you when you come home.
Great. All right, so coming up next, this has been, even more informative than the last segment. So coming up next, we're gonna really talk about why compassionate leadership in healthcare is more important than ever and how empathy can save lives. So stay with us. We'll be back with Real Medicine, Real Lives, along with Wendy Carroll discussing this important topic. Stick with us. We'll be right back with more real stories, real breakthroughs, and real lives transformed. And we're back. I'm Dr. Yasser Sombol. Let's dive right back into today's medical conversation. Welcome back, everybody, to Real Medicine, Real Lives. I'm your host, Dr. Yasser Sombol, and I'm here with Wendy Carroll today, who spent decades helping healthcare organizations operate with excellence and heart. Today, we're going to talk more about compassion and leadership. In a system often driven by efficiency and policy, how do we bring humanity back to the center of care? Wendy, welcome back. And I think this is a great topic, actually, because as a healthcare provider, we get thrown things at us all the time that we have to do as part of the healthcare system. And I think it goes the same for patients. They're dealing with all sorts of stuff. And so talk to us about what compassionate leadership should look like in the healthcare setting.
That's a challenge, I think, in this day and age, when everything's driven more by profit and efficiency and policy than really looking at people. And I think that's why a lot of physicians are going into private practice or concierge type medicine, so they have the time to treat their patients with compassion. They can make their own schedules. And really, I think in the healthcare system, it's listening to the patients, really listening, understanding, and taking the cues from the patient. You can tell if a patient's overwhelmed or if they're totally spaced out. If you have if I think about oncology, which is probably one of the most difficult areas to work in, when you're telling a patient they have cancer, spending the time with them so that they can actually take that in and digest the information, and making sure that you address any questions, and that sometimes people know this isn't a death sentence. And I think having more than 15 minutes to see a patient is critical to that discussion.
No, I agree. I mean, this actually is interesting because yesterday, for example, I was doing a procedure on a patient, and the patient was a do not resuscitate. And so when you do procedures, you know, a lot of times that decision has to be rescinded because you don't want to have a complication, right? And you want to have the ability to resuscitate during that. And for the first time yesterday, I was told that the hospital made a decision that it's no longer the physician's decision to take that decision during a procedure, but they want the patient's family or the patient to decide if that was the case. And I thought that was interesting because I was like, well, I'm being asked to do something for the benefit of the patient, but I'm put in a catch-22 that if something bad happens that I can't account for, that the patient's made the decision that I can't do anything about it, which, you know, puts us really in a bad and a difficult situation. And I think that's a complicated decision to take for a patient, you know, or a patient's family. And I mean, in my opinion, I think that's one of the things where the healthcare system is not really compassionate in that situation. I don't find that to be a compassion at all, to put a complicated decision like that and put you between the healthcare provider and the patient, in my opinion. So, why do you think compassion is actually sometimes missing in the medical environments now?
I think it's going, you know, like you said, it's being driven more top down. We're trying to have all this, you know, it's great that we have patient involvement, even thinking clinical research, you know, getting patient input into what you're writing in a protocol and how you're doing it, you know, making sure it fits within their lives is great. But sometimes the decisions really should be between the physician and their patient, because they're the ones that understand what's going on. They're the ones that actually can have that discussion before anything happens. Like in your case, you could have had that discussion with the patient to say, hey, you know, this is what we want to do. If something goes bad here, what do you want me to do? Rather than putting it on the family at the last second. If the patient wants to make sure their family's involved, that's great. Bring your family in and have that discussion. I think the same goes for when we talk about insurance and getting coverage. I think the physicians are put in a really bad place because you have people at insurance companies deciding what they're going to cover and what they're not. And not even thinking about the physician's medical judgment or how to medically treat this patient. Everything's driven by numbers right now.
Yeah, don't get me started on insurance companies. I think I'll leave that. That's a whole other show that we can talk about for sure. So, you know, and I think it leads to this question, you know, that how can people shift from policy-driven to people-centered care?
Yeah, it's something I think we're missing. The in-between part, it's great to have policies. It helps in guidelines. It means that you get consistent care wherever you go. Great thing to have, but you can't have to remember that sometimes things don't fit within that black and white, which is where the patient comes in, and having that patient-centered care, the patient approach, and being compassionate with the patient. While the policy is there to give you a guideline, the actual what you have to do needs to focus on the patient and their outcomes. Because what they have, everybody's different. You know, what you may see for one person with AFib may be different than somebody else, just depending on their lifestyle, where they live, you know, what else they have on their plate. So you really have to take that all in consideration too. Or if you have people who've been on a certain medication and their family may not like them on that medication because it's a controlled substance for whatever reason, you have to trust that the patient and their physician have worked through everything to make sure that they've tried everything else first before they go to the controlled substance to actually try and treat whether it's pain or sleep or something else.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think this topic right here and this segment right here goes back to the actual healthcare system and how broken it is. You know, as good as a healthcare system we have, it's a very broken healthcare system. And it's not driven by cost efficiency. It's actually driven by, you know, raising prices and inefficiency based on all the things that are involved in the healthcare system, insurance companies, bureaucracies, you know, lobbyists for insurance companies in Congress pushing drug prices. I mean, all this stuff has really made it very, very hard. I mean, personally, from a healthcare provider standpoint, to take care of patients, it's really, really frustrating. And I think that's why there's a huge physician and healthcare provider burnout in this country. And people, less and less people want to go into healthcare because of this reason. So, you know, and so can you tell us, you know, these are great times where I think people want real life experience and a story where compassion changed some sort of outcome or team dynamic from that you've heard of.
Well, and I think it's one, and we talk, you know, as I mentioned earlier, talk about concierge medicine and people going off on their own. And a lot of it is because they want to treat the patient and have, you know, the patient's best interest at heart. I know my internal medicine physician, she happens to be more of a concierge plan, but we can text her anytime. We can, you know, through the electronic medical record, we can get in touch with her at any time we need to about anything. And she's always there. She makes sure, she, you know, when you go for a physical, it's an hour to an hour and a half because you have time and she's really trying to figure out what is really going on and how do we treat the whole you, not just, you know, oh, you have Parkinson's, let's treat the neurologic piece. Oh, you have arthritis, let's just treat the rheumatologic piece. Let's look at everything together and see how it all works together. And how can we have you be the best you possible? And also, what preventative things can we think about now to have you live the longest and best life that you can? And having that compassion really does change patient outcomes.
Yep, no, I agree. And so what's your message to leaders, not just healthcare professionals, but to a message to them to kind of learn about dignity and empathy?
I think, as you said, the healthcare system's broken. We need to get the leaders in the healthcare system, as well as the healthcare professionals. And I think we need to train, go back to the legislators who push a lot of this as well, and really have them remember what it's like to be a patient. What is it like, you know, if you don't have dignity when you're treating somebody, yet they are a person, they're not just a number on a spreadsheet. They're not just, oh, here's my bottom line and what we're going to get out of this. We have places now in this country that are healthcare deserts because we couldn't figure out how to be compassionate and treat those patients with dignity and empathy. And the lawmakers are making laws in such a way that you can't do that anymore, that it is all about numbers. It is all about how much things are going to cost. And they talk about, oh, let's bring down healthcare costs. But the first thing they do is cut the funding for healthcare. And that doesn't really bring down the costs. It's sort of a catch-22. Like, we need to get everybody in a room and really think about how do we make this better in the long run for all patients. And that includes patient advocates.
Yeah. No, I agree. And maybe we'll take 30 seconds and I'll just ask you this one question. So,
yeah.
You know, I think healthcare is really driven because we are a capitalism-based society, correct? Mm-hmm. And healthcare is part of that capitalism, and so it's what kind of runs everything. What's your opinion on this as far as healthcare and being part of this capitalism? Because I think that's the biggest part of the problem, in my opinion.
I think that's one of the biggest parts of the problem is, as a healthcare provider, you're not being taught to treat patients as people. You're being taught to treat them as a number and how much money can I make? And if you think about the cost of med school, it's outrageous as well. So of course you need to make money to pay back all those student loans and actually even get a profit for yourself at the end of the day. So I really think we need to take a step back and look at how our capitalist society as a whole, if we think about insurance companies and pharmacy benefit managers and pharmaceutical industry, the healthcare industry, how it all comes together, is how do we actually make it more efficient, use the tools we have at hand and the things that are coming up to make things better, and give time back to the physicians who really need it to really treat the patient as a whole and start looking at things more holistically rather than as pieces of a puzzle and pieces on a spreadsheet.
Yep, I agree with you. Not that I'm saying we should be a socialist medicine, but I just wanted to throw that out there. All right, everybody,
I think we need to go back to all our legislators and one, teach them basic biology again. But the other is they need some education on how the system really works for real people.
Right, I agree. All right, we're gonna be right back. And when we're returned, we're gonna talk about belonging in healthcare and how patients can feel seen again in a system that often treats them like a number. Stick with us. We'll be right back with more real stories, real breakthroughs, and real lives transformed. And we're back. I'm Dr. Yasser Sombol. Let's dive right back into today's medical conversation. Welcome back, everybody, to Real Medicine, Real Lives. Don't miss a second of this show or any of your Now Media TV favorites, streaming live and on demand whenever and wherever you want. Grab the free Now Media TV app on Roku or iOS and enjoy instant access to our bilingual lineup in English and Spanish. Prefer podcasts? Listen to Real Medicine, Real Lives anytime on nowmedia.tv, covering business, healthcare, personal transformation. Now Media TV is here 24/7 with stories that matter. All right, so as we close this episode today, we're going to focus on one of the most important emotional aspects of healthcare, belonging. For many patients, the system can feel impersonal and cold, but Wendy Carroll believes connection and compassion can make people feel seen again. So welcome back, Wendy, and let's address this issue. You know, I completely agree, because we talked to us in the last segment, you know, how we're numbers and treating people as numbers, et cetera. And so it can become cold, you know, it just becomes like a assembly line and you're like a cog in the wheel, basically. And so why do patients often feel reduced to a chart number or a diagnosis?
Because that's really all they're seen as at the moment. You go in, when you get your paperwork from the physician at the end of the day, what do you see on it? The first thing you see are these ICD-9, ICD-10 codes, which are how you're looked at in the system, is by what your diagnosis is. And they look at how they can do that and, you know, how to get, that's how you get money and get reimbursed by the insurance companies. So a lot of times now, with the short amount of time and lack of providers, we're actually reduced to, here's your chart ID, here's your patient ID, and here's what your diagnosis code is. Oh, you're the patient with, you know, heart failure who smoked and now has some swelling in your legs. Rather than, oh, you are Mr. So-and-so. I remember seeing you. How are your kids? How are things going? And a lot of times, it's because there's no time in the system.
Right. No, and I can attest to that. I mean, I can remember people's faces, and I can actually, you know, I could see somebody and I could be like, I remember who you are now. I know exactly what I did with you. I know exactly what I ordered. Even if they had an intervention done, I know exactly what I stented. But if you were to randomly just tell me their name, I wouldn't remember most of the time, unless I've seen them, you know, for several years and then I remember. But yeah, no, I agree. But, you know, a lot of times I can remember a lot of things about the patient. I just have to remember a face and not a name for some reason. So, and so how can providers, you know, show patients that they are seen and are valued?
Part of it is the compassion and part of it is being able to see the same provider every time. If you think about it, a lot of things like your general medicine, it's a clinic and you don't always see the same provider every time you go in, you just see who's available. So it's really having more connection with a patient and having a true provider-patient relationship. So it's building that relationship. It's actually remembering, oh, hey, you had a birthday last week, happy birthday late, even sending out silly things like sending out a birthday card to your patient. It makes them feel like, yes, they know who I am. I feel seen. I feel like they'll hear me and they value my participation in their practice. And they value me as a person. So it's having those interactions with the patients that maybe aren't always about their disease or what's wrong with them. It's also about, what do you have going on in your life? Yeah, they remember your kids. They remember their birthdays. They remember a little bit from what you told them last time. And it makes the patient actually feel more connected.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And that makes a lot of sense. And I think that's even more prevalent in the inpatient setting versus the outpatient setting, because, you know, hospitals now all have hospitalists, you know, they're on a rotation mm-hmm. schedule, 1 week on, 1 week off. And, you know, there's several different consultants coming and, you know, that I may see a patient on a Friday, but I'm off Saturday, Sunday, and mm-hmm. my partner may see them. And so there's all these variations and people, you know, having to learn about patients. So I could see why that's more complicated. Unfortunately, you know, nobody mm-hmm. can work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, yeah. but you know, it's just, it makes it more complicated. I agree. And so mm-hmm. what role does, you know, community support play in helping people feel less alone?
A lot of times, and I think about the rare disease community a lot with this, is they have a lot of patient advocacy groups. So if you look out there, there are a lot of organizations. You know, I mentioned previously the American Heart Association. There is also, you know, one larger organizations for some of the larger diseases, American Diabetic Association. But in some cases, they're actually really small groups. You know, I know the hemophilia community is a very tight-knit community, and they have, you know, a patient advocacy group, and they actually talk to each other, and they know each other, and they know who they are. And having that support really helps patient. If you're a new patient who's been diagnosed with hemophilia, or you have a child diagnosed with hemophilia, you can actually find through World Federation of Hemophilia, then even the National Hemophilia Federation here in the US, you can find chapters in every state. And they make it a point to actually bring people in and talk to them and give them education about their disease, and also listen to them and talk to companies and others about what it means to be a patient. They're there advocating and making sure that we have the right policies for these patients. In rare disease, you see that a lot, and a lot of it is driven by the parents whose child has a rare disease that maybe never had a treatment. And they're the ones, they go and talk to Congress. They advocate at the state level to make sure people know about this and that they're helping each other. We've had some patients who have rare disease, and when they were able to go to college, they actually set up a rare disease association on the college campus. So all those people with rare diseases could get together and talk to each other and form a little community.
All right. So, yeah, I mean, those rare diseases ones are really tough. And I agree, those support groups are really, really helpful for people, you know, to kind of, you know, establish a network of support in that situation. So what ripple effects happen, you know, when patients feel like people and not statistics?
A lot of the times they're more likely to be adherent to their medications, and they're more likely to tell you when something goes wrong. If they feel like a statistic, they're not going to give you the feedback that you're looking for to be able to treat them better. They're going to say, oh, I'm just a number. They don't care about me. Oh, I had this little bit of a side effect. You know, I got a rash when I started taking this. Eh, who cares? They're not going to pay any attention to that. And they just don't tell you. If they go in, when you go in and you see them, they may not be honest with you about their, what their lifestyle is. They may not tell you, oh, I have 4 or 5 drinks a night. They may say, yeah, I drink. Oh, I only have a little bit. So you need to be able to have that compassion, the empathy, and that connection with the patient to be able to get at the truth, which could be what's hampering their recovery from an illness, or it's causing their disease to get worse because they're not following their treatment plan, or they're doing things that they didn't tell you about that interfere with that treatment plan.
Yeah, I think what you're describing, if I had to figure it out, it comes down to two things. bedside manner and trust, right? If somebody has good bedside manner and can communicate effectively and efficiently and, you know, treat people, talk to them as if they're just normal people in front of you, right? I mean, you know, when I walk into a room and people try to stand up for me, I'm like, don't stand up for me. I'm not the president. You know, I'm just a physician. You don't need to stand up for me. So, I mean, I think making yourself be humble in front of them, that you're just a regular person, just like they are, that has a family, that has children, that has a job, that has whatever else responsibilities people do, has to mow the yard, has to wash their car, you know, and just that, the establishing that connection, person to person, I think that creates the trust, right? And so with that, those two effects, I think you can cause people to be way more compliant, listen to you more, follow your instructions more, trust you more. And I agree with you. I think that really comes down to a big ripple effect that it can result in positive results, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, I'm being able to walk into a doctor's office and seeing pictures of their kids and their family around the room, and not just diplomas. It makes you feel more comfortable and more like they're a real person and not just this person with a degree who's going to talk at you. It really starts opening up those conversations because it gives you some way to get a little glimpse into their life. And you can always ask them about it, because if they're being that open, you know, with the pictures of their family around, you can have that discussion with them and learn about what's going on with their family. And it makes them seem more like just a person and not this god who went to medical school and knows everything and is going to make sure that you're 100% better, but somebody that you can actually talk to and trust.
You know, I like that. I like that you mentioned that. You know, I'm actually going to take that advice from you, and I'm going to implement that in my clinic. I mean, I have not diplomas, but like awards I've earned, et cetera, like top doctor, et cetera, in rooms for patients. Yeah. But I like that family picture concept, and I think I'm gonna put pictures up in every room of different members of my family or whatnot that are around. Yeah, I like that concept. That's really, that makes things a lot more personable. So I'm gonna next time we talk, I'm gonna tell you I did that. That's a promise.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'd like to see how that, if that changes any of the conversations you have with your patients.
I will definitely update you if it does, and I'll tell you about it. So Wendy, this conversation has been both grounding and inspiring. I'd like to ask you to tell the viewers kind of where they can connect with you or learn more about your consulting work and about patient advocacy efforts.
Yeah, no, it's been a pleasure speaking with you as well this morning. It's been a lot of fun. But patients can find, or people can find more about me on my LinkedIn. And I will soon be having a Substack. But it's where I talk both about rare disease, I talk about life, and after our move and living in what I call the Shire, and how that actually works. And then also about just breaking down some of the current health policies and things going on, and trying to break them down into more appropriate language so that people understand what it means for them, and not just the rhetoric that we tend to listen to nowadays.
Great. Wendy, thank you so much for joining us today and reminding us that healthcare is not just about systems and science, it's about humanity. To our viewers, remember this, whether you're a patient, provider, or a leader, you have the power to make a healthcare more compassionate, connected, and real. Healing begins when people feel seen, heard, and valued. I'm Dr. Yasser Sombol, and this has been Real Medicine, Real Lives. Until next time, take care of your health and your heart.